Today, we'll get ready to explore the villages of rural Turkey, where you can get away from the tourist crowds of the cities and experience the timeless hospitality of small-town Anatolia in just a bit. And listeners share the haiku they've written after hiking the trails of rural England and Scotland. Let's open this Memorial Day edition of Travel with Rick Steves, looking back to what started with an assassination in Sarajevo back in 1914 and ignited a devastating world war that lasted for 4 years. It brought about the end of 4 major empires, created new nations from their remains, and killed some 9 million soldiers and 8 million civilians. To understand what the First World War was really like, Michael Korda examines the words of a handful of soldiers in his new book, Muse of Fire. Their poetry, written from the trenches and battlefields, offers a brutally honest assessment of the savagery the politicians and diplomats had unleashed. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Now, you were a child during World War II, yet you write that you've always been interested in World War I. Why is that?
Well, although I was a child in World War II, I was 6 when World War II began, I grew up really under the shadow of the First World War. My maternal grandfather was English and fought in the British Army in the First World War. And my father and his brother both fought in the Austro-Hungarian Army in the First World War. Hmm. So I grew up in the shadow of people who had been in that war. And it had an effect on me. It signifies the end of European civilization as it was formed in the 18th and 19th century. Mm-hmm. It was as if Europe ran over a cliff.
Yeah, I understand we went into World War I with 5 royal families owning most of Europe, and by 1918, they were gone. That was sort
they were
of the
gone,
old regime.
Except for the British royal family, yes.
Yeah. Now, when I was a kid, it was my entire memory was World War I, but originally it wasn't World War I, obviously, and they called it the Great War. Wasn't it even called the War to End All Wars?
Woodrow Wilson called it the War to End All War. Regrettably, he was wrong.
Yeah, but back then it was a noble cause. I mean, young men thrilled to be involved in this, apparently.
Yes, and one of the reasons that I wanted to find a way to write about this war is because I couldn't conceive of adding another history of World War I to the bookshelves. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are thousands of them already in the English language alone. It occurred to me, however, at some point that the British World War I poets and some of the American World War I poets fit neatly into each segment of the war. So Rupert Brooke fits neatly into the first months of the war because he died very early in 1915. And also allows me to write about the period before the First World War in Britain, the Edwardian age, which was self-contented and optimistic. And then, as I say, suddenly in 1914, ran over a cliff. So each poet was involved in a different period of the war, but also deeply involved in the great battle of that particular time. So I saw that would allow me to write about the whole war, but from a different perspective, through the perspective of their poetry and their lives.
I just love this, Michael, how this comes across. And in your book, it is just, it's very engaging. I mean, if I could just jump in and read 3 lines of a poem from Rupert Brooke that you featured. And you said he died 1 year into the war in 1915. How old was he when he died? It must have been
28, I think.
And here's what he wrote. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. Wow.
Yeah, probably the most famous lines, or perhaps the second most famous line of poetry coming out of the First World War. The most famous, I think, is Alan Seeger's, and I describe what an effect Seeger's poetry had, among others, on John F. Kennedy.
Hmm. So what was the most famous poetic line? Because it seems like that Rupert Brooke quote I mentioned there, it's easy to get your brain around, and it really sort of sings of the romance, the crazy romance of the war.
Death on some disputed barricade. was John F. Kennedy's famous preferred line of poetry.
Rupert, that line again was, I have a rendezvous with death.
I have a rendezvous with death on some disputed barricade. And he was interviewed by Edward R. Murrow after he came to Washington as junior senator from Massachusetts. And Edward R. Murrow asked him if he read poetry and if he had a favorite line. And John F. Kennedy got up and walked to a bookshelf and took out a copy of Alan Seeger's poetry and read that line, I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade, which is, first of all, ironic, considering that it's about, I don't know how many years, but not that many years before his assassination. Mm-hmm. But secondly, how many television interviewers today would ask that question of a United States senator, and how many United States senators would be able to answer it with a line of poetry?
Michael Korda is our special guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Michael was editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster for more than 40 years and has written 24 books of his own, including best-selling biographies of Lawrence of Arabia, Churchill, Eisenhower, Robert E. Lee, and Ulysses S. Grant. He's here to tell us about his latest work, Muse of Fire, World War I, as seen through the lives of the soldier poets. Michael, the unique feature of World War I, I think, was the immensity of the death and the reality of the trenches. It was difficult to grasp what the trenches were like, but a lot of this great poetry from World War I came from the trenches.
I think there are two reasons for that. The first reason is that in 1914-1918, poetry was still an important and popular art across a wide range of culture and class. Mm-hmm. Kipling, for example, sold in quantities like a best-selling novel today. And Rupert Brooke, in his lifetime as a young man, sold in enormous quantities. So people read a lot of poetry at every different level. It still mattered in a way that it does not matter significantly to us.
Well, as you said, it was the end of the Edwardian age, you know, Victorian and Edwardian England up until World War I. It was a different time.
Very much so. I mean, you know, in the Victorian age, the thing that most signified to people the horror of the Crimean War was Tennyson's The Charge of the Light Brigade. He read it aloud to Queen Victoria, who burst into tears as he was reading it. We don't have that kind of relationship with poetry anymore. And at the same time, the poets have become more inward-looking. So poetry is very seldom about great events or big news stories. So that's one aspect of it, is that the First World War took place at a time when poetry still mattered to people. The second is that poetry was not very strictly censored, if censored at all. The First World War was strictly censored. There were almost no meaningful photographs of it because the photographs that emerged from the war were mostly posed and intended to conceal what the reality was really like, as was the reporting from the war. There was no equivalent in the First World War, say, of Ernie Pyle in the Second World War. But the poets, their poetry managed to get out to the world at large and convey what that war was really like in a way that nothing else did.
So that's interesting. Poets went in under the radar.
Yes. But it's also notable that, for example, the First World War painters were organized into a cohesive group and given commissions as officers, and moved quite far forward into the trenches to paint what are very often remarkable paintings, just amazing. However, they were not actually in combat. They were looking at combat. But the First World War soldier poets were all of them active combatants who experienced the full war.
So a photographer or a painter would be embedded and controlled by the military. But the poets, they were just combatants who happened to be scribbling thoughts in their little notebooks.
My wife, Maggie, and I went to the Jewish Museum on Fifth Avenue in New York to see the show of the Sassoon family. And Siegfried Sassoon's section of the show contains his notebooks, which are very small, about the size of a modern cell phone. and designed to fit exactly in the pocket of an officer's tunic. And he wrote his poems by candlelight in the trenches with a fountain pen in minuscule writing. You would need a powerful magnifying glass to be able to read it properly. And it's enormously moving.
Especially when you imagine, think of all of those notebooks that were just trampled into the mud and never seen.
Exactly.
It's hard to conceive of the death of World War I. I mean, it's half of all the men in France between 16 and 30 were casualties, something like that. That if you lined up all the English people that died in the war and you marched them by the cenotaph in London where they remember these deaths, if they marched by four abreast, it would take so many hours for them to march by. I mean,
It's nearly a million deaths in the United Kingdom in that four-year period.
And these poets were able to bring home the reality. People who died in the trenches and were celebrated after they were gone.
Many of them. Not all of them, of course, but many of them. Rupert Brooke and Alan Seeger and Isaac Rosenberg all were killed during the war or died during the war. And both Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves were very severely wounded. And Wilfred Owen, the last of the poets, and I think perhaps the greatest of them, was killed in 1918, 1 week before the signature of the armistice, and his mother received the telegram informing her of his death at 11 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, as the church bells were ringing all over England to celebrate the end of the war. Hmm. So there are levels of irony and of tragedy in this that I think mirror the horror of that war.
Michael Korda introduces us to more of the soldier poets he features in his latest book, Muse of Fire. And he recommends sites to visit in Britain, France, and Belgium to better understand what they endured. That's in just a minute on Travel with Rick Steves.